Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
So welcome to the new series of podcasts by Vox Markets. And within this series, we intend to hear from industry leaders who are going to educate the market on their specialist sector. We'll be providing in-depth conversations using experts on their chosen topic. And the podcast series will allow the opportunity for listeners to submit their own questions, which will be asked throughout the interviews. Hello and welcome to the Industry Experts podcast. Today on the podcast, we have Sachin Ozar, who is the co-chief executive of Rehbold Resources PLC. Welcome to the podcast today, Sachin.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you're the co-chief executive of Rehbold Resources. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about your background and what you were doing before that?
Certainly. Most of my background has been on the asset management side of the industry. So I've been an investor in public equities. And the latter part of my career was very much focused on the energy space. So I was looking at all of those oil and gas names from the super majors and integrateds like the BPs, Shells and Exxons, down to the very small independents, who unfortunately have become smaller in scale since I was looking at them those years ago. Really with an understanding of the entire value chain, the overall oil and gas space. Subsequently left the investment management side of the industry to really try and tackle many of the issues I thought were being faced by the industry and the changes and difficult situation they were facing, and essentially started up Rehbold Resources with my co-chief executive officer, Stephen Williams, in order to really exploit the opportunities we saw.
Okay, so Rehbold, I guess, mainly focus on investing in the oil and gas industry. Do you want to sort of explain what's the industry looked like over the last few years, maybe the last 5 or 10 years, and how is that changing moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, the industry, like all commodity industries, has undergone a cycle over that period of time and probably a few cycles. But there have been notable differences on this last cycle that we've seen that really hasn't been repeated in past patterns of behavior that we've noticed. So if we go back to the period of the last oil price having started to spike, if you like, almost pre-financial crisis time, the industry was spending enormous amounts of capital to really try and exploit new resources because so many of the mature basins that they were investing in were going into decline. And that's everything from the North Sea to West Africa to Southeast Asia, almost all of these basins having been opened up at the last boom many decades ago, were really coming towards the latter end of their life. Now, curiously, and if we just take the GFC out of the equation for a minute, the industry did not really in an aggressive way start to try to pursue opening up new basins as a way of getting resources, but started to really exploit unconventionals. And the capital intensity and the volume of capital they spent for what was ultimately very, very little reward resulted in a significant amount of distrust that has built up in the industry. Has built up from investors. And that is to say, despite very robust oil prices, given history, the return characteristics of the industry at large has deteriorated aggressively. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is to do with what is viewed and probably fairly is misallocation of capital. And the industry and investors are really getting to grips with today that significant overspend and that significant value destruction that we saw over the past 5 to 10 years that you asked about.
So you think that the market's sort of catching up from the...
Well, so where I think we are is very specifically on the value destruction element is a lot of the industry put their capital into North America mm-hmm. unconventionals or certainly incremental growth capital. It did not deliver the type of financial returns and financial metrics that was expected of this industry and what they talked about. And investors are disillusioned by that. And as the majors then just reined back in all capital expenditure, it meant that there were a number of actually good quality conventional projects that were just not getting the attention that they deserved. These projects were not being trusted by the investors, and they were not being spent on by the industry. And it almost became this self-fulfilling prophecy that each one was looking at the other and saying, well, it can't be worth anything. But history suggested that was not true at all. Because you can find good quality projects and good quality conventional projects that can really deliver excellent returns. The trade-off that the industry made and is still coming to grips with today is the certainty of being able to deliver production growth, which North America definitely delivers, with the slight uncertainties associated with delivering from conventional resource, because there is some level of subsurface risk mm-hmm. in that. However, it was almost a trade-off of, I will absolutely generate worse returns than having the possibility of generating really excellent returns. And that dilemma and that misallocation of capital is the bit that is really providing the opportunities that we think exist in conventional oil and gas space.
Okay. And if you were to look into the future, I mean, in terms of, say, the price of oil, you've got so many overhanging factors. Everyone's looking towards the renewable market, the EV market. How do you think that's going to affect the way in which the industry is going to shift?
Yeah, so I mean, it breaks down timeline-wise into a series of pressures and factors that are going to be driving this market. So let's first just deal with the near-term issue. So what has changed in the market recently in terms of capital allocation is the trust on North American unconventionals delivering financial returns is now being aggressively questioned by capital markets and by the industry. Now, the oil price spike that has taken place in the past mm-hmm. normally meant there was really big production growth out of North America with significant investment there. That's not taking place anything like to the level you would have expected given where the oil price is. So the near-term support we're seeing today is really, as I said, that fallout from the misallocation that had been taking place in the past. So this near-term pressure of upward pushing of the oil price, and I have to admit, it was a surprise for me, is I think on balance probably going to be more supported than, you know, would have been the case in previous eras of this mini cycle that we've been discussing. As we move into the slightly longer term, there clearly are pressures on the demand side mm-hmm. on EVs for oil specifically. And oil has many uses outside transportation, but I think it's sometimes just too easy to say, well, you know, there'll be growth in all the petrochemical side of the business and we don't really need to worry about the transportation.
I think people underestimate the amount of uses that oil actually, you know, it's in so many different products.
It is. I mean, it's in many, many different types of products. It's in our daily lives in so many ways. But nonetheless, I think you would have to say that there is going to be the potential for downward pressure from the reduced demand from transportation fuels. But there is another side to this that I think is really important to focus on, which is when people look at the growth in EVs and transportation from batteries, the assumption about that is, well, batteries will completely just remove the demand for hydrocarbons. It doesn't work that way because the battery doesn't generate its own electricity. You have to charge the electricity somehow, and that electricity has to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that electricity that is generated comes from the grid. And the grid today, you know, and there is growing renewables on the grid. There's no question about that. But if you were to look at the kind of growth that was necessary to come out from EVs, and if we just look at the UK as an example, you would more or less need to double the amount of production capacity that exists today to replace the fleet of combustion engine cars with EVs. The only realistic way on a 10 to 20 year time frame that can be achieved is from gas-fired power generation. And that gas-fired power generation will need gas mm-hmm. to support that. So the hydrocarbon consumption isn't as easily dislocated from EVs as if there's one unit increase in EVs, there's a one unit decrease in oil and gas. It just doesn't work that way. And I think that's missed in the overall debate. And people have to be aware that when you switch to EVs, there is a system that's going to be required that provides the electricity for the car battery being charged. It's too easy to say that's going to come from solar and wind. Mm-hmm. And I think any realistic view of the world would suggests that you cannot meet a significant amount of that incremental demand from those two sources.
So I know that the UK, they're looking to ban the production of petrol and diesel cars, aren't they? I think it's 2042, isn't it? Do you think that this is maybe a bit optimistic? Do you think all the views of the media are optimistic?
You know, I've sat through a number of government targets that had been set, and the pattern seems to follow the same in whichever change of significant structure of market that you're trying to address. And normally what happens is the near-term targets, and I mean by near-term anything within a 20-year time frame, is totally missed, as in the industry is not able to deliver the government targets. But beyond that, you kind of get overbeats from what the government said because technology tends to change. But the technological changes don't happen in a gentle move towards whatever this government target is. They're these big, significant leaps that take place. And that's ultimately what changes the underlying market dynamic. The problem about setting the 2042 specifically for just breaking the combustion engine is that you are not looking at other ways of technological leaps forward for the use of, I mean, I wouldn't say the combustion engine, but things like fuel cell technology, which was also something that was discussed in the past, that could also make significant changes to air quality and air pollution. That is really what we're trying to address from the use of the diesel and the petrol car. There's much more a local air quality issue that we all suffer from in our day-to-day lives than necessarily the bigger issue associated or the perceived view associated with greenhouse gas emissions. Because as I was saying, it's not necessarily that clear that switching to an EV actually reduces greenhouse gas emissions. But from a local pollution point of view, as I said, the thing that does affect our day-to-day lives is something that is worth addressing, and there's no doubt about it. But you need to separate the issue you're trying to address from the far too easy media-focused view of this is just a bad, dirty part of the industry.
What is really interesting is that you said there has to be some sort of big jump. I was looking into the Danish market, and they've proposed a ban for petrol and diesel engines by 2030. Now, the DUC is a joint venture. There's four companies involved. There's Total, Shell, Chevron, another Danish company. And Shell have pulled out of this joint venture. And the DUC are in charge of 90% of Denmark's oil and gas production. So what I'm trying to say is that Shell are pulling out of one of the biggest producers of oil and gas in Denmark. They're obviously de-risking and thinking that they need to, I don't know, maybe sell in a production where, because they realize that the petrol and diesel cars might not exist in the near term. How do you think that the big companies pulling out is going to affect, say, the smaller companies? And what's your take on Shell leaving this joint venture?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, the way you've laid it out, it's very easy to interpret the Shell move to be a move away from diesel and petrol because of the local targets set out in Denmark. However, oil and really now gas are international products. It's rare, certainly for oil, that the production that you make in one region is really focused on the politics and geopolitics and economic dynamics of that region. It is much more a global commodity than that. So if you produce oil and gas in Denmark, it's really within the context of the overall industry rather than the local policy associated with things like petrol and diesel cars in Denmark, right? And that then, if we look at that portion of it, it is clear that onshore European oil and gas, which was really the foundation of one of Shell's heartland areas many, many decades ago, and specifically European gas, is moving, and elements are moving towards that mature phase of the life cycle of those assets. Shell is trying to build out its own current positions into strong, long, durable positions where they have actually quite a favorable view of overall gas consumption going out in the longer term. So it's probably more a statement about Shell's ability to execute and deliver value out of those hydrocarbon assets in the region. Your point then about, well, where do smaller companies fit in? And that's exactly the sweet spot for so many of the smaller oil and gas companies coming in. Denmark is one area, but we have seen that already happen in the UK sector of the North Sea. When BP pulled out from that region, a number of smaller oil and gas companies came in and took fields that were perceived to be quite late in the life cycle and not able to deliver and extract further value. But the nimble approach to very specific focuses on a particular field is what has allowed that industry to carry on being vibrant. At the time those disposals were made was actually quite a weak time in the oil and gas market. And many of these companies managed to make a go of it. So it's multifaceted, the question that you've asked. I don't think it's an indictment about oil and gas. I think it's more a statement about Shell's own strategy. But it also means it opens up the potential for value creation for many smaller oil and gas companies.
I mean, the infrastructure is already there. The whole plumbing works is all laid out for these companies to go in and you know, re-exploit these fields.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, and again, going back to the point that Shell has spent decades and decades and decades creating all of that, creating the gas market, creating the infrastructure, creating the ability for these assets to be able to be monetized quite quickly. But when it gets to a certain stage of maturity, it's clear, and it's not just Shell, but any of the super majors, it's not their core area of competency to be able to squeeze the last dollars of value out of very late mature fields.
Yeah, of course. So Rheobald, let's talk about, I mean, you could bang on as much as you wanted about renewables and EVs, but you have five assets, is that right? So you've got three UK-based assets, a Romanian and a Californian-based one?
Yeah, so I'll just break down the Rheobald portfolio in a little bit more detail. So Rheobald's made three underlying investments, and the three underlying investments, as you pointed out, was one in the UK, one in Romania, and one in California. Those were three investments, but actually gave exposure to more project areas than that. And to put in some kind of context for your listeners, it's resulted in Rheobald having an exposure to five wells that will be coming up in the near term. I said six because we've already drilled our first successful well in California. But the next two planned wells are in California. And that's a region that's broken down into three individual project groups called Grizzly Island, Munro Swell, and West Brentwood. West Brentwood was the successful well that I mentioned earlier that we're delighted will be in production shortly. Munro Swell, we had some workovers over there, and they're in production. And Grizzly Island is a big exploration upside potential for a gas field. We have further opportunities to be able to exploit in the first two areas, and we're looking at doing that, and we'll, you know, update the market shortly on that. But then if we look at the UK, there are two fields that will be drilled later this year, and that's Wick and Coulter. That's operated by Corallian Energy, and, you know, very exciting potential there. And the final one that we have, which will that we're targeting in Romania, is the Parta license, on which there are two discovered gas fields already. We will be drilling one of those and look forward to, yeah, hopefully a very successful, effectively retesting of an old gas well that was drilled there.
I think what is quite interesting, because obviously a lot of the listeners are investors in the oil and gas sector and probably have very similar questions to you in terms of how do you decide which regions in the world you would like to, you know, which is the best for the oil and gas production. So what do you look at when you want to buy or invest in a site?
Yeah, and, you know, really this comes back to the questions you were asking earlier. So let's just, by way of example, take Denmark again, because we had the conversation on it. Clearly, a lot of companies can go in there because there is evidence of production with infrastructure in place that allows for quick monetization of the asset. And all of that is fantastic. We have one problem from Rehobol's point of view, from assets of that nature, which is they tend to be pretty well priced associated with what the underlying deliverability of the asset is. But what you can do is you can buy an asset that's in pre-production, but has all the other characteristics of an area like that. And that pre-production asset has already been aggressively de-risked. But because a company decided that they were going to walk away from the region in general, it meant that you can drill what we sometimes like to call that last appraisal well. And occasionally, that's actually a development well that allows you to get the asset into production. So why the pre-cash flow phase? And that's all to do with value. When we were discussing the industry and capital markets view about this space, the distrust that has resulted from investors looking at how much value destruction there's been has been so extreme that even for very de-risked assets, you can buy them as though they were out and out exploration. That's where our sweet spot is. Take that very de-risked asset. We have the infrastructure in place. Demonstrate its value, and then get it to the point of monetization very quickly. And that's either through asset sale or through getting the asset into production. California is a classic example of where we've taken the asset, drilled it, got into production, having just closed the acquisition in July of this year. The ability to do that in Romania is also there. The UK assets are probably going to be more of the type of asset that would be available for sale, because both of the fields that will be drilled do have access to infrastructure and have kind of a pretty liquid asset market into which you could sell the asset.
I guess one thing that's sort of obviously coming up quite soon is the US sanctions beginning against Iran. That can be in November the 4th, I believe. Do you think that that's going to have a big effect to, say, the price of a barrel?
In the near term, it always does. The geopolitics associated with OPEC and OPEC-like mm-hmm. countries tends to drive a lot of the view, certainly the traders' view, of where the oil price sits. I have to say, my observations have been that in the past, the ability for fields and very large fields to ultimately get their production into the market in some form or another, and if you like, by hook or by crook, almost always happens. And the example I'd like to give is, you know, when Iraq opened up, and there was a view it was going to lead to a significant amount of production. And a lot of the majors went in there with these hurdle type contracts in place that you had to get the asset to produce over a certain amount and then you start getting paid. And they were called technical service contracts. And they went in there, said, oh, the asset hasn't been looked after, hasn't been produced for a long period of time. We really understand it. And ultimately what happened was they were not able to deliver anything like what they originally assumed from the asset, because funnily enough, even locally, they do find a way of exploiting these resources, and those resources do find a way of getting themselves onto the market. So in answer to your question, it definitely has a lot of news flow and a lot of near-term impact. The medium and longer-term impact, less clear than that, I have to say. The disadvantage of these sorts of sanctions is the working practices on which these fields then kind of operate tend to be well below the industry norms for health and safety and so on. And so, you know, from that point of view, it's quite sad to see the results of...
Do you think that it's going to affect Rehobol personally? Will it stem down to that level or not?
No, I mean, that's not a region we would look at from that point of view. It's not a region we have looked at. And that's, again, because Rehobol tends to focus on areas where geopolitics is not the determining factor associated with whether an asset's going to be monetized or not. This is all about the fact that there is subsurface excessive risk on the entry price that we are exploiting, and we need to demonstrate monetization quickly, not demonstrate monetization conditional or contingent upon some form of geopolitical solution coming to bear. That's not our expertise.
I think if you were to invest in the oil and gas industry, I think people can really get hooked on just staring at the price of a barrel. And in your opinion, do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea?
Look, I mean, in the short term, you know, definitely have to look at it. I'm not going to say that you don't. But I do get asked that question from time to time. And my response is sometimes this one. ExxonMobil is often held out as the standard bearer of value creation when it comes to oil and gas, and rightly so in many ways. However, their return on capital employed back in the 1990s, when oil price was very low, is higher than it is today when oil price is at 70. The oil price is almost, I don't know, something like 3.5 times. Okay. What it is today versus back then, and they have a materially lower return on capital employed than they did have back then. And that isn't just a one-year thing. This has been a trend that's been going on for a period of time. What's my point? My point is looking at just the oil price as a way of value creation for the medium to long term has often been the downfall of the industry when it comes to really trying to make money for investors. So you ask me the question, do I look at the oil price? Absolutely, I look at the oil price. Is it the determining factor for making money for my shareholders? No, it's not the determining factor for making money for my shareholders. And that's the reason. Far more important than the oil price is getting the quality of the project right. The industry has lost sight of that, and that's what's opened the opportunity for us.
Well, Sachin, I think on that note, it's been fantastic talking to you today. And for any listeners out there, if they want to find out more information, your ticker's RBD and you're listed on the AIM stock market, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. So Rearbold Resources ticker, as you said, RBD, is an AIM listed oil and gas company. And we're very excited about the opportunities that the industry has presented to us. And I'd like to thank you very much and thank you listeners for listening.
Thank you very much.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.